we studied the Hilbert space on the T-sphere with some in Wilson-Ein insertions. But I didn't really explain how to analyze the Hilbert space of Trans-Siemens theory on some other two-dimensional manifold. What I want to do today is to explain the general procedure of how one does this. It actually fits really well with what Aldo said yesterday about the coadjoint orbits. So did you explain how one finds the Hilbert space of a Wilson line from the coadjoint orbit, or just get rid of the Lagrangian?
No, not so much.
Okay.
And briefly, I mentioned something.
With the quantization and, yeah, okay, so I'll go into that a bit more detail. So, in general, so, let me remind you of something I mentioned the other day. For any quantum field theory, on, say, some manifold cross or, we think this is space, and this is time, and the signature for this discussion, whether it's Euclidean or Lorentzian signature, actually doesn't really matter very much. Hilbert space is defined as follows. So firstly, you define equations of motion on M to be the set of gauge equivalence classes of solutions to the equations of motion on M cross some very small interval, where epsilon is very small. And the second part, which I want to discuss today, is to notice that this manifold, typically an infinite dimensional manifold, has a natural closed two form. And in coordinates, we can find coordinates p and q such that omega looks like this. So such a two form is called a symplectic form. So normally, if I take a closed two form, you can always expand it in some way, but I might not be able to find coordinates such that it picks up every single coordinate, like every pair of that all the coordinates are paired in this way. So that's a non-degeneracy condition, like the invertibility of the metric. So this is, you discussed some symplectic forms a little bit yesterday, right? And then the third step is that the Hilbert space is defined using omega by something called geometric quantization. So the thing I'd like to explain is, where does this two form come from? Well, what we're going to find is that for most theories, and here there's a slight subtlety at this point for Trans-Siemens theory, but we'll deal with that when we come to it. Omega is equal to d alpha, where alpha is a one form, alpha looks like some pi pqi. So what I want to do is use the Lagrangian to build this one form alpha. Alpha is called the variational one form. So here's how it works. Well, suppose I have a field. I'm not going to say exactly what kind of field theory I have. But if you want to be concrete, you can imagine that this is a scalar field on m times an interval, which satisfies the equations of motion. The tangent space to the space of solutions of the equations of motion, well, that's the first order variations of phi. The cotangent space is a linear dual. So an element of the cotangent space is something which takes a first order variation and gives you a number. It's equal to the set of functionals, the linear functionals, d phi, Now, whatever our one form is, the kind of thing we're trying to build, it's an element of this space for every phi. One form, so alpha is an element of this space for all phi. So that is, alpha is something which takes a field phi and a first order variation delta phi and gives us a number. So this is just, I'm writing on a space of fields which satisfy the equations of motion, something that you know already. So what's a covector? It's something which, a one form on a manifold is something which takes a point on a manifold and a vector at that point and gives you a number. And this should be linear in this first order variation. Okay, so this is the thing we want to build. So any questions? So let's explain how to build it. So as I said before, this is very special. Yep. The way we're going to build this, it uses the fact that the equations we're studying are variational equations. So this one from alpha is going to be built using the Lagrangian. So we let alpha be the Lagrangian. I'll give you some examples in a minute, so for now, let's keep it abstract. This is an N form on M times the interval, where the dimension of M is N minus 1. Because it's the Lagrangian density, it's something I can integrate over space-time. Now, if I verify, you know, I can look how the Lagrangian varies when I verify. L phi plus delta phi looks like delta phi. So by the definition of the Euler Lagrange equations, if I verify, I'll pick up delta phi times the Euler Lagrange equations for phi. But as we know, when we study the Euler Lagrange equations, we have to move things around using integration by parts. So plus the total derivative. Okay, so normally when we do the Euler Lagrange equations, this total derivative doesn't matter. But for us, this is the part that will be essential, because we're studying what happens on M, which you can think of as the boundary. Yeah?
What is N? The M bigger than N minus 1?
N is the dimension of this whole manifold here.
N is the dimension of M cross minus epsilon comma epsilon.
Yes. So N minus 1 is the dimension of M. So first, this total derivative is the thing we're going to care about. So firstly, we note phi satisfies the equations of motion. So the first term vanishes. And so let's write the total derivative as L boundary, L tilde by delta phi. And this is an N minus 1 form. So, take that back. Where the total derivative is d. To be a total derivative, must be d of an n minus 1 form. So I'll write it as d of L tilde, where L tilde of phi is an n minus 1 form. So now we know, we can kind of see what is our alpha. It's just the integral of L tilde. Alpha phi delta phi is the integral of L tilde. So this is a little bit abstract. So let's look at a couple of examples, and we should recover really familiar things. For quantum mechanics, you'll find dp/dq. Quantum mechanics, M is a point. phi is a function on the interval. A Lagrangian is integral phi del t squared phi. Now, sorry, drop the integral. The Lagrangian is phi del t squared phi. So if I vary the Lagrangian, L of phi plus delta phi is equal to L of phi plus delta phi del t squared phi plus phi del t squared delta phi. Now, if phi satisfies the equations of motion, so that its second derivative vanishes, I'm going to move this in the other side. I wanted the variation of it. Sorry, I should have had, when I wrote it earlier, I shouldn't have had L of phi plus delta phi. I should have had minus L of phi because I wanted how it varies. I wanted the derivative of the Lagrangian, so sorry about that. So phi satisfies the equations of motion. This is then phi times del t squared delta phi. Well, now, if we were allowed to integrate by parts, I would move this derivative over here and then do that twice and use the equations of motion to show that vanishes. So let's write that out carefully. So it's del t of phi del t phi delta phi. Delta of phi, delta phi, minus delta t phi This part comes away. Okay, did I get that right? Yeah. So this tells us L tilde is equal to the term inside these brackets. Phi del t delta phi now so phi satisfies the equations of motion, so it can be written as something satisfying the equations of motion, it's very simple. It's just p plus d times q, like q plus d times p. So phi is q plus dp. So this expression here, when I integrate it at t equals 0, at t equals 0, L tilde gives q delta p minus p delta q, which is great. So that this is the variational one form, and the two form, it is d of it, is the right one, dp dq, or 2 times dp dq. And then omega is equal to, say, minus 2 dot p. Any questions about that calculation? As you see, it's pretty easy. And the only content is just you pick up the integration by parts term, and you turn this into the symplectic form.
Would this be in generally, I mean, this total derivative term has to do with our Nutter theorem or our conserved currents. So would that be in general the case that L would just be the conserved current?
Conserved current for what?
That's
right. It is related. There is a related computation which will give you the Hamiltonian. But this is not the same because if you think about this one carefully, I didn't really need to choose coordinates on t. Like to do the Hamiltonian, I need to choose a direction which is time. That gives me the Hamiltonian. Here, this just could have been any n manifold with boundary, and I would have got this. Okay, so let's quickly do a few more examples. If we do a scalar field in dimension n, and so phi is a function on m times minus epsilon on the Lagrangian, is phi the Laplacian on m of phi plus phi del t squared phi. Well, actually, this case is just exactly the same. The reason is we assume m has no boundary. So total derivatives in the m direction these can be discarded. Because ultimately we're going to integrate over m. So if I have d of something an n minus 2 form along m, it doesn't matter. So we're really only integrating by parts along time. Parts along time, we get alpha is the integral over m of the same expression. Okay, so let's do one more example. A fermionic field on m times an interval. So the Lagrangian looks like L is psi times the Dirac operator of psi, which is equal to psi gamma 0 del t psi plus psi, the Dirac operator along m of psi. So this term has no time derivatives, and this term only has time derivatives. And it's a first order derivative. There we find alpha, the one form, is the integral around m of psi gamma 0 delta psi. So the fermions don't split into p and q in the same nice way. All the components of the fermions are really on the same footing. Okay. So the next thing we want to do is to study this Bertrand-Simons theory, unless there's any questions.
Sorry, what was the last remark I didn't catch?
Oh, so here we don't really split things into p and q. So for example, I say omega is the integral over m of delta psi gamma 0 delta psi. It's not like dp dq in general. So for instance, if you wanted to, as I'll see later, if you want to choose a boundary condition, that's what's called a Lagrangian submanifold, where you set half of the variables to zero. That has to, you would set half the fermions to zero, whereas here you could have set p equals zero or q equals zero.
Notion of conjugate variables in the fermionic?
Yes. So if we were doing fermions in one dimension, we would find it's a Clifford algebra. The algebra is a Clifford algebra generated by psi I with the relation that the anti-commutator I psi j is delta j. And this whole thing is a symmetry of SON, so you can't split it up into raising a lowering operator without breaking the symmetry.
So if we don't have conjugate variables, how can we define this subjective form?
So in this case, the symplectic form is like e psi I, e psi j, delta I j. So we know these are fermionic variables. So the symplectic form is supposed to be anti-commuting, but we pick up an extra sign because they're fermionic variables, so it's okay that's the delta I j. So it's just not, it's a fine symplectic form, it's just not written as dp dq. If you wanted to write it as dp dq, you would have to say, suppose we had two fermions, then you could change basis and say psi plus is like psi 1 plus psi psi 2, psi minus equals psi 1 minus I psi 2, something like that. And then you would get the synthetic form looks like psi plus or psi minus. But this choosing this basis does not respect all of the symmetry of the problem. Well, this is about, dimension two is a bad example because it actually does. But If there was four variables, it would not respect all the symmetry, because then spin 4 would be broken to SU2. And actually, the same phenomenon will happen in transatlantic series. So let's take M to be the 2 torus in coordinates theta 1, theta 2. We can ask, we take the group to be U1 to start with, then the space of solutions to the equations of motion on G2, this is equal to gauge equivalence classes of flat U1 bundles. Now, there's natural functions on these space, on this space. So if I take my torus, I can ask, what is the Wilson line around that, or the Wilson line around that? And these provide coordinates on this space. So this space is also a torus. Which you can think of as U1 times U1, where I can take the exponential of the integral around U1 of A, that's an element of U1, and the exponential of the integral of U2 of A is another element of U1. Yep.
What is a flat bundle, like a flat connection or
not? So flat means the curvature vanishes. So let's choose coordinates on this U1 times U1. So I'm going to choose. It would be convenient to choose multi-value coordinates. Say lambda 1 to be the integral, and lambda 2 to be the integral U2 of A. So these coordinates are really the logarithms of the natural coordinates. So as I move around, they kind of glue together. Otherwise, they have a periodicity.
So does lambda 1 and lambda 2 coordinatize without being multivalued, coordinatize the flat U1 bundles without taking the gauge quotient?
Yes. Okay, so lambda 1 and lambda 2 coordinatize the flat bundles for the group OR. And then there's extra gauge transformations, the group 1, which make those identifications. But on a little, I mean, this. So the space of flat bundles is also a torus. And if here is the base point where the gauge field is trivial, lambda 1 and lambda 2 are perfectly good coordinates on this little patch there. Or indeed on any other little patch. And you know, maybe e to the 2 pi I lambda 1 are the better coordinates. OK, so what? So let's do our calculation. So what is the Q form? Well, I can take any gauge field A, and it's working near the trivial gauge field. We can write any A solving equations of motion as lambda 1 d theta 1 plus lambda 2 d theta 2. So the Chern-Simons Lagrangian is ADA so it's going to be pretty clear what we're going to get if I do a first order variation of A. That's delta A DA plus A D delta A. So that's delta A D A plus D A delta A, which is minus. Plus D A delta A. Now, if A is a flat connection, so dA is equal to 0, so the Chern-Simons Lagrangian, the variation of it, I forgot this term, is equal to d of A delta A minus 9. So this expression is a variation of one form. So now, what we have to do is write A like this and see to describe it in terms of the variations of the lambdas. And it will be very easy. So inserting A is lambda 1 d theta 1 plus lambda 2 d theta 2. So that delta A is delta lambda 1 d theta 1 plus delta lambda 2 d theta 2. We find the one form alpha is minus integral over the 2 torus a dot a equals minus integral over the 2 torus. What do we find? We find lambda 1 delta lambda 2 minus, if I do a with delta a, it's lambda 1 delta lambda 2 minus delta lambda 1 lambda 2. Since these lambdas are constant on the torus, so up to a constant, and I'm going to be, I'm always going to have trouble normalizing these constants. So it's up to a constant is and therefore the Q form omega is So, to sum up, what we found, not being very careful at calculating the constants, is that this natural two form on the torus, which parameterizes the solutions of the equations of motion, is just the volume form on the torus. And if we normalize things correctly, the integral of this normalization integral over T2 of omega is equal to K, the quantized Trin-Simons level. Okay. Questions? So Aldo said a little bit yesterday about why these things are quantized, right?
No, not really.
No, really?
Just say it like this.
Okay. So I wanted to be able to get to computing the Hilbert space, but I don't think we're going to be able to do that. No, maybe we can start doing that. So given a manifold X and a symplectic form, omega, then the procedure called geometric quantization produces a Hilbert space. So how does this work? Well, let's start the case x is O(2n). And omega is some dpi / dqi So in this case, we define Zi to be Zj Pj plus square root of minus 1 Qj. And this, if we do this, we identify OR2n with Cn. And the important feature is that omega has nice behavior in these coordinates. So omega looks like, I think, 1 over 2i sum dzi wedge dzri. So this is the kind of picture we're going to generalize. We're going to say, whatever my x is, I want to define complex coordinates like this, which locally make it look like Cn, so that omega looks like dz dz bar. Well, then the Hilbert space is functions of the z. So it's holomorphic functions of P and Q. Functions of z bar, i.e. functions of P and Q, which satisfy the Cauchy-Riemann equation.
Is this the definition of Hilbert space that we must have a holomorphic function?
That's what you said?
Why we say it's holomorphic function?
Well, so perhaps you would have been more familiar with the story where I would take functions just of, say, just of Q, right? That would be, I say, L2 of Q. That's the standard thing done in quantum mechanics. They're very closely related. So roughly, so if you take, so you would, so I'm setting it up, I want to look at functions which do not depend on z bar. Whereas the standard thing in quantum mechanics would be look at functions which do not depend on momentum and only depend on position. But you know that in quantum mechanics, I could have also said, let's take those functions which only depend on momentum and not a position. And it's the same by the Fourier transform. So there's integral transforms which relate any way of, given any way of choosing half the variables, they're all kind of the same by versions of the Fourier transform. This one is one that works on curved manifolds, basically. The Hilbert space there, well, they satisfy the Cauchy-Riemann equations, which is so does this description for quantum mechanics make sense to everybody else? So let's. So what happens globally? So if we have a manifold X, and if globally our two form is d alpha, where alpha is a one form, then we do the same thing. That is, we choose holomorphic. We choose a complex structure on X which is given by coordinates zi bar locally with the feature that the change of coordinates is holomorphic. And then we also assume that locally omega can be written as some g I j d z I with d z r I, or j, and then the Hilbert space is defined to be. Is the space of holomorphic functions on X. So that is, in this case, when we make this assumption that globally omega is d of a one form, which does not happen in Trin-Simons theory, because in Trin-Simons theory, the two form is the volume form of the two sphere, but it's not d of anything, because its integral is non-zero. Not in the two sphere, on the two torus. Under this assumption, all we do is we just look at holomorphic functions on X. So if we were studying the two torus, this ansatz would lead to studying holomorphic functions on the two torus. But in the case when this does not hold, when omega is not equal to d alpha globally, but only locally on X, then this is, for example, X is d2 and omega is d lambda 1 where d lambda 2. Then this ansatz only works locally. And the gluing rules are changed. So I'll say more about this next time. But what we're going to find if we look at the example of T2, what we find next time with this omega, well, if I on each patch, for example, if I view T2 as a quotient of the plane by a lattice, then on that plane, like locally on that plane, I can write omega as lambda 1 d as d of something. But on that plane, this piece here will not be periodic. So when I study the holomorphic, on that plane, I'm going to be studying holomorphic functions on the plane. But they will not be holomorphic functions in the torus because they won't be quite periodic anymore. And you will end up studying things like theta functions. And so so the general story we will find is that abelian Simons theory for any Riemann surface, the Hilbert space, is always expressed in terms of some kind of 19th century type special functions, okay, like theta functions on that surface. Okay, stop there unless there's any questions. Yeah?
So, for me it's very abstract to see this Hilbert space as a space of holomorphic functions or defined by these holomorphic functions. So I don't know if you can say a little bit more about why this is a Hilbert space.
You could maybe do a tutorial on the Bargmann representation.
The Bargmann representation?
Yeah.
That's actually a really good idea.
That would explain what.
Because you can see the raising and lowering operators acting on this space, is that what you mean?
I think so.
Yeah. So up to linear transformations P and Q, they're related to Z and Z bar. So Z and Z bar should have the same canonical commutation relations as P and Q, because omega is also written as VZ to Z bar. So on this Hilbert space, there's raising and lowering operators given by multiplication by Z, and Z bar gets sent to differentiation with respect to Z. So if I just look at holomorphic functions, suppose I'll just look at those holomorphic functions which are polynomials in one variable, like Z to K. And there's a vacuum vector 1, and these are obtained by hitting this with, I have Z, del Z, they're raising and lowering operators, and every state is obtained by hitting it with this guy. So that's like a pretty familiar Falk representation. And this is just the same thing with many.
Can one use omega to endow these Hilbert spaces with an inner product?
Yes, great question. So what will happen is, there is, so this story describes field theories which are not time reversal invariant. So the Hilbert, when we say Hilbert space, the concept of Hilbert space, I think I've put this before, is tied to the fact that applying time reversal is the same as applying complex conjugation. So a time reversal is, I take my vector space, the space of states, I take its dual. In complex conjugation, then I get a Hermitian inner product. So these theories are not time reversal invariant in that sense. However, you can tell that doing, time reversal invariant, like reversing time sends omega to minus omega plus a particular constant. So for particular values of omega, yes, you can get a Hilbert space. Like there's some very special coefficient there.